Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 56 featuring Brandon Davis. Steven is joining me on the podcast intro today. Steven, do you know Brandon? Have you ever met Brandon?
No, I know of him from the online community, but I didn't actually know much about him until, I mean, for most people don't realize we do these intros after sometimes you've done the interviews. And so I've come to find out quite a bit from the last,
Yeah, he's pretty cool. And you guys were both, talk on 3D Pro, or we all talk on 3D Pro, and you guys are both military people, right?
Yeah, it turned out we have a similar background and probably landed in the industry for similar reasons.
Yeah. Well, he's been an old friend of mine for a long time, and I actually haven't seen him in over 10 years. So I was super excited to see him. I used to work with him at DD. We talk about a lot of interesting things because Brandon's a very interesting guy. He graduated high school but never went to college, and he's always felt a little bit different about that. And we talk about how he has self-educated himself. And he's actually, like we mentioned, he was in the military as well. He was in special forces for years. He actually used to go on missions while we were working at Digital Domain. Believe it or not, he'd just take off. And then he'd come back for a while. He was in Iraq while we were at DD. He decided that now it's about time he has to use his GI Bill, which is to go back to school. So he's actually going back to school, which is a really interesting thing for me as well. It was pretty awesome to see him. And I really hope that I'll see him again soon. But I want to say something else, Stephen. You've been on the podcast a couple of times, and you were on the Daniel Lay podcast, which was pretty awesome.
Right.
I think it is high time that we make a podcast about you so people understand a little bit more about you, because I think you have an interesting story as well.
I might have a story or two.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll do a Stephen Parker story as well, so that would be great to do. All right.
Actually, maybe we can get Brandon back in, and he and I can talk about nothing related to CG.
Yeah, that would be pretty good. All right, so a couple of reminders. If you guys like things that we put out, please make sure and let us know. Or if you don't like them, let us know as well. Make sure and leave your comments if you have anything or any suggestions you have or guests you have. Make sure you rate us on iTunes or let us know on Twitter if you have any feedback, and et cetera, et cetera. Our Twitter is @CG_labs. And if you can also do Chaos Group as well, it says @Chaos Group. And we're also on Google Plus and LinkedIn, etc. All right, guys, thank you so much. Hope you enjoy it. I wanted to add a few words to the introduction to this podcast. A few days ago, someone that I knew really well, Andy Lesniak, passed away at the age of 41. He was the kind of person whose light shine twice as bright as most other people. He was really an amazing person. To call him the MacGyver of visual effects would be sort of an understatement. He's the kind of person that would go to Best Buy at 4 o'clock in the afternoon because someone asked him to they needed a tracking system for a camera rig, and he would construct and build and design the software of a camera tracking system and be ready on set the next day. He was always inventing things, always had things that he was building in his garage or in his living room, always creating amazing work. He was so diverse, it was incredible. And he was also very humble. He never really sort of looked for amazing praise for his work. He just sort of did it. And I really loved that about him, and I feel very humbled having known him. I'd say, if anything, this podcast, especially in light of what we did and talked about with Brandon Davis, is really about embracing life as much as we can. And I think it's really great to be able to celebrate that now. And hopefully we can celebrate what Andy did in his life as well. Feels kind of silly to add a silly song at the end of the introduction to this podcast following these words, but I think Andy would have appreciated it. Andy, may your illumination be global and your ambience was never occluded. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Andy.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
I like to leave it on silent all the time just because I hate having a phone.
So what do you use to talk to people? Do you use your phone? Because you use Facebook a lot. Do you use it over your phone?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I text more than I've never in the entire time I've owned a cell phone ever come close to using all my minutes.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I just don't like talking to people.
Well, didn't they change that on cell phones recently where they don't care about your minutes because no one uses them anyway?
Yeah, everyone's using data. Yeah.
Now it's all about data, right?
Yeah, for the most part. Yeah, and on Facebook, I'm kind of like on and off. It's weird. Sometimes I go through my little opinionated tirades. Other times I just enjoy just kind of seeing what other people are doing. I mean,
right.
I have a love-hate relationship with Facebook. But at the same time, you know, it's been a great way to just keep in touch with people that you don't normally talk to on a day-to-day basis.
Sure.
You know, old friends and whatnot, seeing what they're doing.
I've literally joined Facebook like 2 months ago, 3 months ago.
Oh, really?
I've been fighting it for so long. I don't know why. And after a while, I was saying, I had a reason why I was fighting it, but I don't remember anymore.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't care. And it's amazing how quickly, like, oh, reconnecting with people. And you know what? To be honest, it's all the same people, right?
Yeah, for the most part.
It's all the people I already know. I mean, are you on 3D Pro?
No, I was. Actually, I still am, but I don't read it.
Right.
Yeah, I think my big thing was that when I came back from the war, my life had changed pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
I stopped getting involved in the industry. I stopped doing stuff at SIGGRAPH. I stopped going to SIGGRAPH.
Right.
And I stopped reading 3D Pro. I started doing other things besides 3D stuff after work.
Right.
It just became a job, so.
All right, well, we're going to get to the war part because I want to let people know where we knew each other before we started working with each other.
Yeah, I think it was the 3D Max forums.
We were on the 3D Max forums.
Yeah.
I was still working in the architecture side of things, and you were in VFX. You were at Blur for a while.
Before that, but I was really prolific on the forums in the late 90s when I was at Computer Cafe.
That's right.
Because I was just one of a handful of people back then that was using Max on movies.
Right.
Yeah, and it was a Lightwave house that hired me to do effects work because just back then Lightwave didn't have very good effects tools and Max had a growing suite of effects tools.
Right. And you were using
Afterburn.
Afterburn, that's right.
Yeah. And that was actually a funny story because I had been connected with a group of struggling Max artists in the Bay Area,
like
Torbjörn Olsen, does, you know, Max 3D and whatnot. And he had connected with Krešimir Tkalček in Croatia, who had basically said, hey, look at this cool thing I'm making. And that led to Afterburn. And so I was one of the handful of people who even knew how to use it, even when it was in like alpha version.
Yep.
And through the IRC forums, because it was like the Max board and there was also IRC.
Yep.
And the IRC forums, this guy was like, hey, you know how to use this software? We need help on a movie. And this is the funniest thing. This was early 1998. By this point, I'm kind of given up trying to be an effects or a visual effects guy, because this is during the SGI years.
Right. And you were still a guy using Max on a PC, right?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, back then, I had just moved from, you know, 3DS, DOS.
Oh, right, DOS. Yep. So Max got into Max. Right?
Yes.
Max 1.0.
96, yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was only a couple years in. And it was strange because everywhere I would try to apply to, they'd say, oh, well, if you don't know SGI, we're not going to hire you.
Yeah.
And there was also a little bit there too, where it was like, oh, you never went to college? Yeah, we're not going to hire you.
Right.
It's kind of that was a very short
lived
time.
Do you think that was true?
It seemed like a little bit around 97.
Because I want to get to when you and I went to DD, it was like whatever the fuck you were doing.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, no, totally.
Yeah.
And that was actually most of the time. But there was a little period of time there, I remember, in like around 97, where they would say, oh, we require a degree.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because they were finally putting out, schools were having degrees in, you know, computer animation and things like that.
Yeah.
But then the amount of people they suddenly just not allowed in, all these really talented, you know, uneducated artists like myself.
Sure.
You know, so they changed it to or equivalent experience.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you're not uneducated. You just lack a degree.
Well, I never went to college. I had never went to college.
I know you did. Yeah. I know that, but we'll get to that point because this is actually going to be something I want to talk about because I think it needs a little bit of encouragement in people.
I'm going to have to swing this microphone out for a second and take my jacket off because this leather jacket is starting to heat up really quickly.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Go ahead. We'll do that. Oops, I got it.
This is the sound of a jacket coming up. All right. Back to normal.
But it is kind of funny to be in LA and it's cold, right?
Yeah, well.
Well, it's not cold anymore. It was cold last week. And by cold, I mean like 45.
It's kind of, yeah, it's kind of, it's weird because I was here briefly in September and it was that heat wave.
Right.
And I'd never, after 10 years in Venice, I was like, wait, it never gets over 100. What the hell? And it was just brutal.
Yeah. It's weird. So you just started a computer cafe for, just doing Afterburn stuff. And
Well,
you were sort of like a lone gun guy, right?
Yeah, I'd kind of given up trying to, I had gone for at least a couple of years after the Army trying to get into the industry and not getting any luck. I was barely making, you know, scratching by. So I had kind of given up and taken a job as a producer slash editor. And I was just doing 3D just for the fun of it.
Really? Where were you doing that?
Yeah, I was in the Bay Area.
Okay.
Yeah. And like I said, early 98, computer cafe guys, they're like, hey, can you come down for 5 days and help us with this movie? We can't tell you what it is, but yeah, it was Armageddon.
Right.
And we have this shuttle launch sequence where we have these plates of these model ships they took off, and we had to do trails of rockets and smoke, and there's no way to do it. And these guys think that this new hypervoxel thing is going to work, but it's not ready. And
right.
So and here's the funny part. I had to convince my boss at the time at this company, hey, can I take 5 days off and go work for another company?
Right.
But I mean, that was where I got my break because I went in, and it was weird back then too. Hand tracked it all. There was no like, I think 3D Equalizer was out, but there was no real crazy tracking software.
No.
It was just Super Spray.
Yeah.
Like the simplest particle system in the world with Afterburn, and did 3 shots in 5 days. And then I went back to my job.
Really?
Yeah. But then like a few months later, there's like, hey, why don't you come work for us full time? Mm-hmm. We can't pay you much. And I mean, it was chicken scratch, but like, I didn't even hesitate. I just threw everything in my car and moved down to the Central Coast.
Yeah. I don't think you had a problem with that. I don't think that's never been a motivation to you about like, you know.
Yeah. For me, at least back then I had gone.
You were also much younger.
I was in my late 20s.
Right.
But I it was just this point where I wanted so badly to work on movies. This is something I'd wanted to do since I was a kid.
Sure.
And here was the chance, and it was just like, well, we can only pay you so much. I'm like, I don't care. I can eat ramen.
Right.
You know. So
that's cool. Well, so you and I knew each other from that a little bit. You'd known that I'd been kind of a V-Ray guy, I guess, through the forums as well, because I was always talking about V-Ray. But I was more like a user. I didn't work for Chaos Group or anything. I was just really passionate about it.
Yep.
And then we both ended up working at Digital Domain where we had to give up all of it.
Yes. Yeah, well, I had been trying to get away from Max for a bit because I was more interested in Houdini.
Right.
But no one would hire me because they're like, you don't know Houdini. I'm like, ugh. You know, there was no apprentice version or anything back then.
Right.
And Digital Domain, I think after I saw the XXX Avalanche sequence.
The Avalanche sequence, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, I'm like, I want to work there. And it was one of these situations where, again, they wouldn't talk to me, but Bob Coleman over at DAA had been talking to them, and he was like, hey, well, what if he can try to explain like why he would make a good person to work on this movie?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote an essay where I basically broke down like, look, I've been using this great tool. It's really procedural driven, kind of like Houdini, but it's not at that same level. I mean, because Max was a pretty procedural tool if you wanted it to be.
Right.
And so I said, I feel like a kid who learned how to play guitar on a, you know, $100 Sears guitar, you know.
Right.
And I've gotten as far as I can go, and now I need to move on to a proper, like, Fender Stratocaster.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave Prescott read that, and I think he saw my Army background and thought that was interesting. He's like, just hire the guy.
Good that you brought that up, because I had David Prescott on the podcast, too.
Oh, nice.
And David and I talked specifically about you.
Oh,
and
really?
About how, you know, he just thought there was a lot of, you know, interest in how you were bringing in. And also the fact that back then at Digital Domain, they seemed to hire people not necessarily based on what degree they had or what check marks they could put on a list, but based on character stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And it was the same kind of thing with me when I got hired there. I was interviewed by Andy Weisler. Do you remember Andy?
Yep.
And Melanie as well. Mm-hmm. And they, Andy came from an architecture background and he interviewed me. He started asking me questions about, okay, all right, so you don't have your experiences, but have you done this and have you done that? And he goes, yeah, he gets it. He totally gets it. He can fit into this place. It's not necessarily the same thing that we check off every day, but he gets it. And also the fact is back then it was hard to find Houdini artists, so they had to make their own.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you totally hit on that point perfectly. Like they wanted to work with people that they thought would be fun to work with.
Right.
It seemed, you know?
Yeah.
And especially with a big show back then, you'd ramp up on these big shows that are going to be, you know, you're going to work on them for a year and a half. Whatever. It wasn't like this thing where now it's like 20 houses working on a show for 3 months. It was like one main house or two main houses working for a year and a half. And so they huge ramp up. So you had room to bring in guys who were fairly, they might be experienced, but like people you could kind of mold.
You know? And you basically you'd have, you know, months to become the person that you needed to become.
Exactly.
Also, because of that, and because all these people were working together, you created huge bonds between stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Day After Tomorrow was a huge example of that, besides the fact that we were all sort of growing into that role. And that was a big show for DD at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So they ramped up with a lot of new blood.
Yep.
And we had time to do that. On top of the fact that they had some history of craziness going on the show.
Yeah.
That also provides a bonding experience between people.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing, again, going back to the military, there's nothing like mutual suffering that creates those kind of like laughing, you know, bonds.
So I obviously got to know you a lot better once we started to hang out together at DD, and we used to hang out a lot. And, you know, obviously Martini Night was one of the big things.
Yeah. And I have to jump in real quick because I remember the very first thing I saw you in dailies, and you had just built the Hollywood sign.
Yes.
That was going to get destroyed by a tornado.
Yeah.
And you had this great like ambient occlusion render, like turntable, and it had all the structure and scaffolding. And there, I think Teal said something like, yeah, that's a bit much, but okay.
Well, I'd built it in like a day, but I was really proud of it. So I made like a beautiful like turntable of it because, you know, you're like, you want to show off your work when you're new in the industry. And I was like, it's a freaking Hollywood sign. And Mel came over to me. She's looking and was like, wow, that's a lot of detail. It's like, how good is that going to look when it's about 100 pixels across and get destroyed, covered up by a giant tornado? Mm-hmm. But I'd built a little overbuilt. But I remember one of the things that was interesting to me specifically, hanging out with you is that you had like, you had basically been advertising the fact that it's like, no, I don't have a college degree. That was, that was part of your identity, right? I don't have a college degree. You were at the same time, also everyone was fascinated. You were kind of interested in the fact about you by not having a college degree and being different that way. Everyone was fascinated about the fact that you were in special forces, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They were all like, this guy, he's a big military guy, he's in special forces. And then suddenly you disappear for a few months. He says, Brandon had to go somewhere. It's like, where did you go, Brandon? I can't tell you, but I can tell you that my Korean has gotten a lot better.
it was never as like sneak and peek as cool as everyone, you know.
No, of course not.
You know, reality is often much more bland and boring than the perception, but still, yeah, that was kind of a funny thing.
Yeah. And you went to Iraq for a while as well while you were there.
Yeah.
And you sent us a blog.
Yeah, that was a fun thing because, you know, we had the life mailing list.
Mm-hmm.
And where we just talked about all kinds of random stuff.
Yeah.
And I think before I left, I had tested trying to email into the life
from a different
outside.
Account.
Yeah, and it worked. I think Dan Nolliman's like, yeah, it totally works, you know. And so, and I was there. I think the first month or so that I had gone on the deployment, I had written, a physical, you know, like journal of you
right.
Know, I had made this. You know, I didn't have a lot of photos from my full-time Army years throughout the 90s, like late 80s and 90s. And so I had made an effort to like, I'm going to take lots of photos and videos. I want to document this whole experience I'm going to have.
Right.
So I had all these photos and video. I had been writing in a notebook But what I'd figured out was that it was very time consuming and a little painful on my hand
right.
to write. So I said, well, I'll just compose. I can type so much faster.
Mm-hmm.
And then I next thing I know, I had to organize it. So I used HTML to organize it into this thing. And it was just for myself. But I came to realize, like, my family, you know, eventually.
This was a way to use it. And it's, there was no, it wasn't necessarily a formal blog. It was just
out of
your website.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, at the time I had a website called ParticleEffects.com
right.
where I was just, I wasn't really trying to promote myself so much as just trying to promote tools and stuff. Like, mm-hmm. I had worked really closely with Oleg Byborodin to try to develop Particle Studio into Particle Flow. Mm-hmm. And when that first came out, back then still it seemed like Autodesk wasn't so, you know, you'd have a product come out, but there wouldn't be a lot of tutorials available and stuff. So I'd do that kind of stuff. And so I just had it as like a hidden directory on that website.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I started sending it out to family first because – I mean, I had disappeared and gone on that deployment, and then I didn't get in contact with anyone for like 3 months. It was like we were so far away from everyone and so not in the normal soldier situation. You know.
And this was the second Iraq war.
Yeah, this is, so this would have been summer of 2004.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I remember you were doing at that time, and a lot of stuff that was going on in your blog, was talking about a lot of the humanitarian stuff you guys were
involved
with.
So I, had, you know, in the 90s, I had been in the Army Special Forces community, which is, you've got the, I mean, Special Forces is kind of a generic term used these days, like, you know, commando stuff. But there is actually the oldest group in the Army for special operations stuff is the Army Special Forces, the Green Berets.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to 1952. And it, the, one of the things that makes that group unique is everyone's language trained. Everyone learns, you know, cultural things, and they have a region that they're assigned to. So there's guys in first group that have the Pacific Rim. They have Asian languages. Guys in third group have Africa and the Caribbean. Fifth group has Central
See,
Asia.
That's education, by the way.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. It's true. And if you have an affinity for languages, you know, it's
– So how many languages do you speak, would you say?
Well, I don't think I speak any fluently that well anymore.
Well, how much could you, how many can you communicate in?
Oh, see, I can do French and German, a bit of Japanese, and then in Iraq, I was very good with Arabic and Kurdish.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah.
Just an immersion thing, you know, like I hang out with German people like I did the other night with...
And you start speaking German.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So it's one of those things, usually when alcohol is involved.
Right. Well, fine. So yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah.
that journal was really powerful to us, and I thought it made... especially in light of, you know, what we were feeling. Now, was that happening? No, that was happening after Day After Tomorrow, right?
Yeah, that was, yeah, I basically had to run off to war to escape that movie.
Right.
Yeah, so and, it came out, I think, while I was over there, maybe?
I think so. But yeah. We were all following that journal really closely.
Yeah.
And we, the company itself and the people that were involved in, you know, with you felt very, very attached to it. And it became a very important part of the bonding thing. And that, but before we, I want to skip back a little bit because you were basically saying, you know, oh yeah, I don't have a degree in something, right? And I have a lot of degrees. I've got a master's in architecture. I've got a bachelor's in mathematics and art. And so I love education, but I don't necessarily care about the degree. The degree is not what got me what I'm doing,
right?
The degree is what is a piece of paper at the end that showed that I went through all the steps. But really, the thing that I enjoyed about education is being around the right teachers, learning the kind of stuff that I like to learn, and also learning how to learn. Because the point of education to me is that especially if you're in a subject, like visual effects is a perfect example. If you're going to learn something in visual effects, everything you do has to be different than it's ever been done.
Yeah.
Almost by definition of visual effects. So every time we start a movie or whatever, you have to learn something new.
Yeah.
Or try something new.
Come up with a novel approach.
Novel approach or whatever. So that education is what allowed me to learn how to learn or learn how to...
Sure.
Innovate in some way.
Yeah, college also, I think, gives you a foundation thing. So, you know, as a self-taught visual effects guy, and especially as an effects guy in particular, there's a lot of math that you kind of have to get to know.
And yeah, and I agree. And I think that right now, especially in some of the, you know, the colleges out there that are you know, for-profit education, they are going out there and they're saying, here's the answer. is you know this, then you're good to go.
Right.
Which is wrong because that's going to change all the time.
Exactly.
And you were always you are one of the most educated people I know, to be honest, because you have diversified your education by learning so much, right? Who else do I know? You're the only person I know that basically if you go to someone's desk in visual effects, most people have a bunch of anime characters, everything else. You had a stack of foreign affair books.
That's true.
Okay.
True.
So you were learning about foreign policy while everyone else was obsessing about, you know, Star Wars characters or anime.
Yeah, I was like that.
So
yeah, a lot of things interest me.
At the same time, while you're doing foreign policy, you have an interest in science. You have a huge interest in science. Obviously, if anyone follows you on Facebook, they know that you've got this what's going on in science and everything else. So I think what's important, what I learned, you've always stood out to me as an example of one of the people that has the best concept of what education is, of what it's important about it, because you've never formalized it, right?
You could say that. I mean, I think honestly the road I took in the military was such that you had to take initiative and responsibility to get to where you wanted to go. And I think in the process of doing that as a young guy, like I started when I was 17, you come to this realization that the answers are out there if you can know where to find them.
Right.
And so you don't have to wait for someone to teach you. You don't have to be taught. You can figure it out on your own.
Right.
It might just take you longer. Or as what I was trying to get to before is like, you may not have the proper foundation. So you may learn how to tweak a fluid solver looking at the math and then wonder why it's not working. And then you have to go over to the PhD guy and he goes, oh, you didn't normalize that vector. Like, well, why do I have to normalize that vector? Well, that's math 101. Well, I learned it the Cliff Notes version. So.
Right. No, it's true, but a lot of people don't know that.
No, it's true. Yeah.
And you're not, you don't have to have a PhD in physics to be a fluid dynamics visual effects person.
This is true.
Not anymore. You used to.
Yeah.
but not anymore. And I think that, you know, just learning that process is an important part of the deal. But also I remember, you know, obviously you were one of the, when we were there through that bonding experience, you were one of the original Martini Night Cartel guys.
Yeah. And that's an interesting story because a lot of people thought we just wanted to put on parties, which is true.
Not the case.
But yeah, it was started, Corey Rocco Floramonte basically was making martinis at his desk on Friday afternoons.
Yep. And he had this old martini case that he had.
Yeah, he did. It's like
50s,
a suitcase. Yeah.
A little suitcase.
And
he popped it open, click, click. Opens it up. Inside are some beautiful martini glasses, a shaker, and a bottle of gin.
And the four of us, so he and Steve Blakey and Dan Nolan and I were part of the paraphernalia team.
Right.
So Dave Prescott had put together this team to do kind of just random odd stuff throughout the film, like, you know, swinging cables and debris and things like that. And we, as a team, kind of got to know each other pretty quickly.
Yeah, you guys are all sitting in that four slot right there.
Yeah, right there in the digital building. But we didn't know anyone else, really.
Right.
And so he, being a very outgoing person, said, well, let's just throw these parties and we'll get to know people that way.
Well, what happened before that even started, I remember just hanging out with you, because I would stop by your desk, obviously, because we were chatting, and I got to know Corey and Steve and Dan as well.
Yeah.
You guys are like, wow, look at that case of martinis. Like, well, do you want to have a martini?
Yeah.
But the problem was I was on the second floor.
That's right.
And so I couldn't come down, and you guys were having, you know, your martinis. And so he had to signal to me that the martinis were being served on Friday and what time it was. So he had this thing. By the way, at the time, anyone could page anyone at Digital Domain. All you had to do is dial *4 or something, whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd be able to page anyone in the building. So he would dial *4 and start shaking the martini shaker in the speaker. And I would hear that. And it was like a Pavlovian response. I would run downstairs and get a martini. For a long time, Martini Night was only like a handful, maybe 10 people.
Yeah, yeah.
He's like, oh, gee, I got to start bringing in a couple more glasses, and we would hang out. And then I would just hang out with you guys, and my wife would come off work, and she would not drive home. She would drive to Digital Domain, and we would have martinis at Rocco's desk. Now, Rocco was also the kind of person that had a bunch of stuff with him.
Yeah.
So he'd also have like, oh, I've got some Twizzlers, I've got this.
It's always a big thing of Red Vines.
Red Vines, right. And so I remember one time, he was drinking martinis through Red Vines.
Sounds about right.
and that basically started, and it evolved. It got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, he was promoting it in a way like he was trying to like bring it to the next level every week, it seemed.
Every week. And then it got big enough that people were, we were all on that. Not, you got to imagine cubicles, kind of cubicles.
And there was like 300 people at the company then. It was fairly.
Yeah, it was pretty big.
Yeah.
And kind of cubicles. And then everyone would sort of end up in this area. So now suddenly we're like, oh crap, we need a lot more glasses. We need this.
Yeah.
Someone decided to start DJing.
Yeah, yeah. That's and right. Then, Kai Bouvard came in with his DJ set up.
Yeah, like literally in the office with all the cubicles going on, people still trying to finish shots. And we're like,
I was being the wine snob of the group, and, oh, and like I would email like on like Friday afternoon, hey, by the way, tonight's wine for tonight will be blah 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 blah. Yeah. Blah.
and it got a little out of hand after a while.
There was one particular incident that is what pushed it outside, though,
which is the hair incident. Right?
No. That was relatively unknown. It was prior to that. I'm sorry, it was after that.
Oh, okay. Because we mentioned the hair thing on a previous podcast.
Oh, you really? I'm with Dave Prescott. I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. So just so people know, I lit Karen Galikas' hair on fire. That's one of my great claims to fame, I suppose. It was an accident. It was a flaming Zambuca game that we were playing, and her frizzy hair was right next to my finger. And
I blamed it on David, and he said, no, it was Brandon. He says, but he started the fire.
This is true. And she was a great sport. She just kind of smiled and went, oh, okay, yeah. But I was like, smell of burning hair at my desk.
Yeah, please, yeah.
But yeah, after that, at some point, it just, you know, we were going pretty late. And someone peed on a couch or something.
Someone peed in a trash can.
Yeah. Oh, that's what it is. That's right. And Jeff Stringer was like, you got to take it outside.
Right.
This is it. It's over.
Which is funny.
Yes.
They didn't say it's over.
Right.
They said, you got to take it outside. It's like taking the, like letting the dog outside.
Yeah. And you got to remember, this was also a time at Digital Domain when the commercial people were very segregated and they didn't come over and hang out with us at all. And they were starting up their own sort of martini night thing. And they had this little bar made that was like a little, it was like a stool with a glass table or something.
Right.
And so.
Actually, it was a pretty nice little bar.
It was actually, but it was a teeny little thing.
And they were, the commercials team was very separate. It was separate almost by choice. They separated themselves and the feature film people separated themselves by choice from each other. Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I remember Rocco basically said, well, can we have the party outside and just build a bar out there? And Jeff Stringer said, yeah, sure, that's fine. But he was thinking the size of the bar that was over in commercials.
Right, which was not very big.
No.
Like one person could stand behind it.
And then there was just one night, I think, where he just, Rocco says, hey, check this out. I've designed a bar. And in Maya, there was this full built out 4-station tiki bar. And he had come up with a way to figure out all the 2x4s he needed and everything. Right. And Yeah,
and then you guys built that bar overnight. I mean, in a weekend.
We built the first part overnight. It was like a Thursday night.
Yeah.
We built the first section, then we finished it, I think, that weekend or
and
so.
And it got to be a really big – in fact, that bar still had – I don't know if it's all there, but still had some pieces left. We had to break it down because it was getting kind of rotten.
Yeah, yeah.
But they tried to save the tiki parts of it, the tiki statues part of it. I don't know if they made it to the next building.
We had the little chutes that people would donate. Yeah, so the thing with Martini Night was that we would go out and buy all the booze and everything, and then people would just donate into these little chutes. And it was just like a free party in a way.
Generally broke even most.
Yeah, sometimes we would lose a lot of money, then sometimes we'd gain a lot of money.
So it evened out.
Yeah, it evened out. Yeah.
And what was funny about it is that, like you said, there was probably about 300 people at DD, but suddenly a lot of outside people would come in.
Oh, well, Craig Cannon had free reign to bring in women off of Main Street.
That's right.
So it wasn't such a sausage fest.
So basically there was a lot of people that would come in and they'd come into Martini Night and there would be like 500 people every Friday with DJ music coming.
Yeah.
And the cops would come every night because there was one neighbor that pretty much didn't like the music and we'd have to turn down the music. But it was besides that,
we would go late, like midnight a lot of times.
Yeah.
And Todd Dufour was famous for being the guy who would always sign the ticket from the warning from the police. We had a wall full of all the warnings.
We had a bunch of that, and it was all donation-based. Yeah. And a lot of interesting people showed up. And Martini Night was kind of a big thing. I mean,
it was a big bonding experience, I think, especially because Day After Tomorrow was such a difficult show to work on.
Yeah. And I remember when it was still a little bit small, and was outside, what's his name? Volker Engel used to come by.
Yep.
And he was such a affable person, like really great And he would.
Well, I think that's because that was when I had my plan for DD was only to work there 6 months because I was leaving to go work with him on this German miniseries.
Right.
And so I was still coming to work on. I was working. I'm not at DD anymore.
Right.
I'm working on this TV show, but I'd come for martini night to help out.
Right.
And like he would come and other people and whatnot. So,
yeah, he would hang out with us. And then I remember that was the first place when I met Paul DeBevick, who now he and I are good friends. That was the first place I met him was at martini night. So it was really a good thing. I even remember there was a time at DD when we were talking about something that we were trying to do to promote DD, and they had a... They made these little groups of people to talk about things. Yeah. And Jeff Stringer was there and Evan Jacobs was there and a bunch of other things. And we were talking about different things we can do to help promote DD because I guess they needed to do a lot of recruiting at the time.
Yeah, well, SIGGRAPH was coming up that
SIGGRAPH
summer.
Or something like that. And then we were talking about what we can do at Martini Night. And Jeff Stringer says, I think we should all agree that Martini Night is very successful and therefore we shouldn't change it. And what was interesting is that, you know, that is something that a company like DD at the time not only, you know, enjoyed, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't want to mess with it. They let it be the way it was. And they knew that it was a successful thing and helped the industry.
It was
helped,
good for esprit de corps and morale. Yeah.
And for the morale and general, and that's something that wouldn't happen today, I don't think.
No, yeah. I totally agree. Especially, I mean,
it was dangerous to be honest.
It was, you know, the Scott Ross years were, it was very much big boy rules.
Like, right.
You can get away with stuff, but you know, you own it if you smash it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you know, we're lucky that a lot of, you know, because a lot of people got really drunk over there.
Oh yeah. And well, so, that's what we also had that rule, like if you, some people were persona non grata, like right. You're responsible for your guest.
Right.
There was like a plus one rule. And if your guest got out of control, it's like, no.
And what was funny is that it was you behind the bar, right? Rocco behind the bar, making drinks for people, whatever. And there were some people that would come in that had no idea what this was. And they'd ask for random drinks. And they're like, no, sorry, buddy. And we're like, we're making this, we're making that. And they're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, what kind of bar is this, man? It's like, you can't make a Manhattan?
It's like, no.
We're not bartenders,
we're not bartenders. We're not professional bartenders. We're making this. And I mean, Rocco had it. I mean, Rocco had his vision of what he wanted, right?
Absolutely.
In a lot of ways.
Well, he had always wanted a bar, to be honest.
He always wanted a bar. But he'd loved, you know, like, he'd put out like little cups of cigarettes, different types of cigarettes if people wanted to have a smoke outside this and that. And so he had this idea of what he wanted, and he that's a person who really took loving life to the extreme.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, like he was really, really,
and there are a lot of members of the crew that really, really went out of their way to help. Like, we got, you know, a lot of like ringers to come in and help us make drinks.
Yep.
Raul, he came in, he was doing margaritas at one point.
Oh, right. Raul.
Yeah.
Brian
Grill was always a heavy donor. He donated like $200 like almost every time.
Wow.
You know, or he'd bring in a giant bottle of like Belvedere vodka or something.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm reminded of something.
Okay.
So, at DD, during a show, every show had its own homepage.
Yes. So well, we had an intranet.
Yeah, we had an intranet. So this was only internal, but every show had a page, and on that page you'd go for information. This was before Shotgun or anything like that.
Yeah.
So you'd go to that page and you'd look up the information and say, okay, here's my shot, here's this and that, whatever information was relevant to the show. But the front page had an image that you could put on there.
Anyone could change it at
anyone any time. Anyone in the company could easily just change the image anytime, which would always be this ongoing joke of whatever would happen. And there was a picture of this girl. I forgot her name. It was a snapshot during Martini Night of this girl kissing Rocco.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was another one of her kissing you.
Yes.
And what I did is, as I took the girl out of both pictures and made you and Rocco kiss.
Yes.
And I put that on the picture.
Yeah.
And you both had your eyes closed and you were like,
we were doing posy kisses, you know,
right.
Like, ooh, hello, you know. Yeah. There was also one where I think there had been a pool party at Rocco's house over the weekend. And at one point, I'm in the pool kind of by myself, and Rocco says, hey, all the women jump in the pool with Brandon.
Right. So, and it was you in a pool with like six girls around you.
Yeah, all in bikinis and everything. And then next thing you know, that goes up, and then within a minute
that was me.
Yeah.
Was it
all the heads of the women were replaced with
Ricky Martin.
Ricky Martin, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
There were some funny ones.
That was some good.
I remember one point, there was a Japanese artist, Gaku.
Gaku,
he went back to Japan, got married, and then there was a photo of him, the family, and it would look like a samurai wedding. I mean,
so traditional clothing.
Oh my gosh. It just said Gaku Stairu. I saw him at Weta, and it was like my first thing I thought of was like Gaku Stairu.
Yeah. So you went to, you worked on this stuff with Volker for a while.
Yeah.
And you were still hanging around in California for a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, so after 9/11, actually I'd say prior to 9/11, so I had gotten out of the army. I'd done like 6 or 7 years full time.
Yep.
Gotten out to do computer graphics. But then right towards the end of my time in the Central Coast, I was going to move to LA to go work at Blur. I'd really missed the army, and I was actually going to quit. I was just about to turn 30. I was going to quit and just go off actually to the Ranger Regiment, 75th Ranger Regiment, for like 4 years, because that was just something I kind of wanted to do. But it was kind of a weird thing. It would have been strange to go from SF to Ranger, usually the other way around. And there would have been a lot of issues about going back full time that I just said, well, you know, I've worked so hard to get where I was with computer graphics, and it's such a fast, dynamic industry. It's like if you leave for 4 years and come back, I mean, everything could change, you know?
Sure.
So I tried to find a happy medium, and there's a part of the Army Special Operations community called Civil Affairs. It's Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations, which is a lot like the Green Berets, just without the gunslinging. It's all the diplomacy, winning hearts and minds. So it's basically helping governments fight guerrillas and helping guerrillas fight governments.
Okay.
And it's more of the pressing the flesh, talking with people, organizing networks, helping to...
Sounds very political.
It's very political. You end up being the middleman between, say, a large military force in an area and the civilian population.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So you have to, you know the language, know the culture, and you have to use a lot of soft power and not like kicking doors and blow shit up.
Right.
So... And that's mostly made up of reserve units. Reserve units being, you know, part-timers. And
right.
Because you want people who have skills you don't get in the military, like cops, firemen, construction people, engineers, social workers, stuff like that. Visual effects didn't work for, you know, at all.
Yeah. But let's do some animation together, guys.
Exactly. although that's another funny story. I did some animation on Sky Captain in the World of Tomorrow while I was in Iraq.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But so... it was to go from SF to Civil Affairs was a chance to be kind of a big fish in a little pond.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a chance for me to kind of do it part-time as like a mobilization augmentee or whatever. But this is prior to 9/11. This was 2000.
Right.
And then 9/11 happens. And it's just like, well, gosh, I'm ready to go fight.
Right.
So I switched to freelancing, got the boot from Blur, which Tim Miller says that I was the best person he ever fired.
Yeah. I've talked to him about you, actually.
Oh, yeah?
I did a podcast with him, too.
Yeah. Because I basically said, yeah, you should fire me.
Yeah. He said that exact story.
Yep.
Yep.
But unfortunately, I didn't really get to do everything. It wasn't really the best fit for me, but it was the best way to balance continuing visual effects from time to time and doing military stuff and helping the war effort. You know?
Right.
But, yeah.
So then what ended up leading you to Weta at that point?
I had gotten out of the army completely in 2007, and I had wanted to go back overseas again.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2010, Syndicate had broken up.
Yep.
And I was kind of back to freelancing, and I missed being at a big place like Digital Domain.
Mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to live overseas again, go somewhere. And I didn't want to necessarily go to London. And I had friends at Weta that just the timing was right. And I'd actually gone to Australia with the plan of working there.
Yeah.
But everywhere I talked to, just nothing was really a good fit.
Right.
You know? And then Weta just seemed like a perfect fit. And they had a really good offer and everything, like a guaranteed year of work.
Yeah.
So,
but you were there for a long time.
Yeah, like 5 years.
5 years.
Yeah. It was a good fit.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember you posting a lot over there, and you know, just hearing from you was good. It was just sort of good to touch base, and then knowing that you're in a good spot. And then I think it was on Google Plus, and you put a post about cancer on there, and I freaked out.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That was the first time I'd known about that. I didn't know anything about that. I said, have I not been paying attention? What the hell's going on? And Johnny Gibson, I think, responded as well. It's like, what the hell, man? And
I'm kind of like, it's weird. I can't be dramatic sometimes.
I expected that kind of, to be honest, from you, I expected you to be like, well, got cancer. Yeah, you know,
that was it. I emailed my family. Hey, so I've got kidney cancer and it's stage 4 and blah, blah, blah. And of course my dad he calls me right away. Like, what the hell?
Yeah. Like, yeah, and that's the kind of way you put it. It's like, yep, nope, that's... And I say, is it bad? He's like, oh, yeah, it's really bad.
Yep.
So...
You know, it was kind of a weird thing. You know, that was the... I had come back to the States. I usually came back during the holidays.
Yeah.
I was in L.A., and I woke up one morning, had this weird lump in my belly, and I think I went to, like, urgent care over in Playa del Rey, and they're like, yeah, that could be this, but that's not right. You should get it, you know, ultrasound or something. And I was on my way back to New Zealand where the healthcare, you know, thing was really easy.
Right.
And they looked at it. They're like, yeah, you've got a giant tumor on your kidney.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the beginning of the roller coaster.
So you were diagnosed in the U.S. with cancer, right?
No, I was in New Zealand.
You were in New Zealand. Did you stay in New Zealand?
I stayed in New Zealand for a while. So the first thought was, let's just remove the kidney and the tumor, because it hadn't really gone everywhere yet. It was just, it just was massive, and it was looked like it was about to spread.
Right.
So I guess it might have been technically stage 3. But mm-hmm. I had the operation in July of 2014.
So they removed the kidney.
Yeah. And it was great. I was in 11 days. I was back to work.
Wow.
Yeah. No, I've got Wolverine genes, apparently. I like regenerate and heal so fast. It's insane. And everything was going great. And they're like, yeah, you just need to do a CT scan every 6 months, make sure it hasn't, you know,
spread.
It hasn't spread or come back.
Right.
And the very first CT scan, they're like, yeah, it's spread to your lungs. It's regrowing back where we cut it off from your kidney. It's in some other areas. I'm like, oh, man, now it's stage 4. Now I'm in big trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the point where they were like, well, we're going to put you on this pill-based chemo
mm-hmm.
called bzopanid. But my family was like, no, come home. I'm like, all right, fine. This is going to be interesting because I have no health insurance and, you know.
In the U.S., right?
In the U.S., yeah.
Even as an American citizen. I kind of want people to realize that he's an American citizen. He can come back to his country, but he has to pay for every dime.
Yeah. And
while he was in New Zealand, not a New Zealand citizen,
yep.
You got free healthcare.
Right? Yeah. Well, it isn't free. You pay for it with taxes, but still it's
one. No, I understand
that. It's a much different attitude where you don't wait till the last minute to get checked out and stuff, right. You know.
Yeah.
So I came back and paid through the nose to get checked out at UCSF and Stanford. And the great thing was is the oncologist I met with in Stanford, she's like, you know.
Yeah, but aren't you a veteran? Doesn't that make a difference?
She says, wait, if you're a veteran, just go to the VA. I'm like, well, I can't wait a year to get looked at, you know, because remember the VA was going through this craziness, long waits. And she goes, no. The one in Palo Alto, which is where I was,
mm-hmm.
Is one of the best in the country. I can be your doctor, you know.
Right.
So I went there and it was all covered. It was, you know, good.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they put me on the same stuff I was going to have in New Zealand.
Okay, good.
And I reacted well to it. Everything was starting to stabilize.
Right.
And I got bored sitting around. So after a few months, I just went back to New Zealand.
Okay.
Yeah. So basically, I went back at the end of 2014.
Uh-huh.
And within a month, like all kinds of bad things started happening to me. I got checked out again. And they're like, holy cow, there's this new tumor. All your other tumors are kind of stable.
Right.
You know, and this chemo didn't kick my butt. It turned my hair white. It made me fatigued, but it didn't. Right. It wasn't like, you know, nausea and stuff like
right.
that. But now I'm getting all these other weird side effects. You know, it was pretty nasty. And they're like, no, it's spread to your lower colon area. And it's like, it's growing at like a breakneck pace.
Jesus.
Yeah. So then I went through this whole process with the New Zealand healthcare where like did a colonoscopy and they're like, oh yeah, that's definitely the same thing. You've got, you know, kidney cancer, renal cell cancer down there. And it's like, okay, let's operate. Let's cut it out. Well, it's kind of in a weird place. It's dangerous. And you know, basically went through all these different surgeons. They're like, yeah, we're not touching that. No.
Wow.
And so my doctor was like, and this is now by March or April mm-hmm. of 2015. And they're like, well, we can do some radiation and maybe shrink it, you know?
Right.
And I talked to the radiation guy. He goes, dude, you're an American. America's got amazing healthcare. Just go back home, man.
Okay.
Just do it properly. So that's when I basically said, oh, I guess this is.
That's it.
That's it. That's the end of my time at WETA. It's the end of my time in the industry. I mean, I also got to a point in the industry where I'm like, I think I'm done.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you get tired after a while.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the time I had turned 44 and I had kind of lost my passion for mm-hmm. it all. I mean, a lot of that was the beginning of the end of my career was actually coming back from the war.
of course,
my attitude about life in general had dramatically shifted.
Yeah, because like you're wondering whether anything you're doing is really relevant or important, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be prior to that, like when I first got the DD, I was one of those guys that I would go home after working 10-hour days and I would
learn more stuff.
Learn more stuff, you know, and I would really get out there and I was doing tutorials and I'm like talking at SIGGRAPH and doing, I was really involved.
Yeah.
And I just dropped off the face of the earth. I just stopped doing all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
But you just basically were doing shots just to keep you busy in a way, right?
In a way, it was just it just became a job.
Right.
And when I got out of the Army completely, I realized this time I needed to fill a void, like, you know, because I was still doing physical fitness and things like being a soldier. And I got back into long-range rifle shooting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So then I just had, like, I filled that void with that, and it became my new hobby, and I'm, like, making my own precision ammunition. And so that was kind of, like, one of my little side things I was doing, and I would just go to work and do computer graphics during the day.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, I'm not a gun person at all. Well, I'll take that back. I'm not going to get into gun laws or policies specifically, but my mother as a child – her father was a hunter back in Hungary and stuff. And she always learned that, you know, the big thing about guns is, first of all, if you can do anything, if whether legal or not, you need to learn how to respect them and make sure you understand the safety.
Sure.
Of it. So she gave me a BB gun as like, this is the baby version of what you need to understand. Point it down. Don't do this. Don't do that. You know, safety, understanding and respecting guns are not things to just randomly shoot things.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to shoot things, do it for a reason.
Yeah,
right?
Of course.
And so I didn't shoot any animals or anything like that. That wasn't what I did. But what I like to do is I like to shoot targets.
And yeah.
Targets were a lot of fun to shoot. And the precision of it, right?
Yep.
And then cut forward to, you know, 20, 30 years later, me watching videos of you with a sniper rifle shooting something that's like 2 miles away and in a mountain in the desert going boom ding.
yeah there's quite a delay.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a delay there, but you figured out, you know, all the trajectories and all the stuff going on. It was like if I'd continued to do what I did back when I was 12 and taken it, you know, at the same amount of time, I probably would have ended up kind of where
I mean, for me, it's kind of like computer graphics. Precision shooting, long range especially, is kind of a blend of art and science.
You know,
it's an art of marksmanship and a science of ballistics. But
yeah.
For me, a lot of that stuff was really just, not only was it just something fun to do, shooting steel targets and, you know, not shooting Osama bin Laden paper targets and being like some of these nut jobs, but just something, you know, something simple that I enjoy doing. But it also kind of reminds me of, you know, back when I was a soldier. I'm not trying to like be cool and all, but it was... Like the way I try to explain to people is like, well, if you were a race car driver for 20 years and you retired and then now you race on the weekends with your buddies, it's kind of that same thing. You're kind of, maybe you're reliving your past, but
it's just something you're good at.
Yeah, it's something you get enjoyment out of.
And you know? If you're good at it, a lot of times, like you said, you get enjoyment out of it. So why not do that?
But, you know, in America, it's hard because if you are serious about firearms, you automatically get lumped into this really strange subculture of... like very heavily, well, filled with very paranoid.
We are very
people.
Quick to label people.
Yes.
We love to do it and end up, oh, you are this, so there you are that, right? And that's ridiculous to do that, right? And so I hate the fact that, you know, you were very good at weapons. I know who the kind of, what the kind of person you are. And no, I would never associate you with an NRA guy who's going crazy about guns and gun laws and how everyone has the right to protect themselves and the solution to gun violence is more guns. I know that that's not the kind of person you are.
No.
So that's one thing that I think is important. You know, a lot of people have these weird policies about doing stuff, but I've always listened to everything you've had to say and I've always taken it very seriously. And even things that, you know, like your policy, you know, like the not your policy, but your ideas of what guns are and what you do, I've always respected that. And I think that's really kind of a cool thing. So it's good that you kept yourself busy doing that.
Yeah, it definitely prevented me from going, oh, I missed an army and going back. Although, granted, I miss jumping on airplanes and flying around in helicopters and stuff. And, you know, that's a void that's harder to fill. But this has just been a nice little thing to do on my own. In fact, being in New Zealand was great because the culture there, the shooting culture is geared around hunting and target shooting.
Right.
And as long as you cross your T's and dot your I's and, you know, don't piss off the police, you can go do that.
Right.
So, yeah.
I remember you sent me a video of a New Zealand soldier funeral.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was the three guys that were killed in Afghanistan.
Right.
Yeah, and they're all doing the haka.
Yeah, that was unusual.
That's just kind of the neat thing about New Zealand, the way that the traditional Maori culture is kind of woven into the European culture as well.
What is that?
Well, you had the local tribesmen, essentially, mm-hmm. that were there when the Europeans came,
mm-hmm.
what, 200 years ago or so.
Right.
They had their battles, but instead of wiping them out like we did,
mm-hmm.
they eventually kind of came to a happy peace, and the two cultures kind of blended together. And they had their ups and downs, believe me.
Sure.
But it's interesting in New Zealand where, I mean, imagine the only corollary, like kind of analog I can think of here is imagine if every time you went to a baseball game, an American Indian group or people came out and did a rain dance or something,
right.
you know, but like not American, not Native Americans, but just all Americans kind of, you know, or if every time you went to a government building
with respect.
Yeah, yeah. If you went to a government building and they would say, you know, the Federal Building of Los Angeles, and they would also say it in like Miwok or something, you know?
Right.
So there's like a respect for the traditions that were there before.
Right.
So it's a very interesting blend of the two. So what you're going to end up getting is, you get the local, you know, Scots College down the street where it's a prep school for kids, and there are all kinds of different ethnicities there. And at the end of a soccer game, they're all doing a haka back and forth out of respect.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what by doing that, by making it a part of the entire culture, doesn't no longer makes them a minority in a way.
In a way. I mean, it just, everyone kind of takes a bit of ownership with it, I suppose.
Okay.
It's also a unique thing about the area. So it's an
identity. New Zealand's also a small country, right?
Very. Size of California, 4.5 million people.
Is it really the size of California?
Yeah, roughly. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I loved about it, because I'm a bit of a misanthrope. I don't like people that much. I mean,
sure.
I may be friendly, but I just don't like dealing with people a lot of times. And New Zealand's a place where you can just kind of get away from people very easily.
Very easily, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Karen and I, actually yesterday we went to Palm Springs to get away for a few days, and we ended up going on a hike in the desert. And I was like, we haven't seen someone in 2 hours.
Yeah.
That's awesome. We haven't actually seen anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, just not being around people sometimes is good. And not having no cell phone connection or anything too is nice, because that means we have to talk to each other.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, and that's nice. That's nice to be
able
to.
It's like being on a road trip across the country,
yeah.
with a broken cassette player or something. So you're forced to talk. You know?
Yep. Yeah, I think that's great. That's kind of nice about it. And there's always something to look at and something to do.
Yeah.
So you're still fighting cancer these days, right?
Yeah. So it's interesting. I had a solid, you know, like I said, beginning of 2015 was a roller coaster, just nothing but bad news, bad news, bad news, bad news. And eventually I pulled the plug and I'm like, I need to go back to the States. And at this point, I was really going downhill health-wise. I mean, I was losing weight. I was losing energy. I was in constant pain.
Yeah.
And I just told Weta, like, look, sorry, I need to leave. And at the same time, I kind of knew my career was over with visual effects. I was done.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if I was going to survive. Essentially, I didn't know. Like, my doctor there was saying you might have, like, 6 months to a year.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was just thinking, like, well, I'm either going to go back and die, or I might win, and then something new can happen.
Sure.
And one of the things I had is I still have my GI Bill to use. I had this thing. Yeah, oh, I didn't need an education. I can educate myself. Well, right. I also had a bit of an inferiority complex that I'd never been to college.
Yeah, I don't know why I still have that.
Oh, well, it's just a weird thing. And so here was my opportunity. Like, well, okay, if I beat cancer,
mm-hmm.
or if I start to win at least, and I need something to do, I'll
get a PhD in physics.
Yeah, I'll go to school. I'll go to school finally as a 45-year-old freshman.
Sure.
You know, and so...
Do you really want to do that? Absolutely. You still want to do that?
I'm already signed up. I start on Monday.
Really?
Yeah.
Where are you going to school?
It's a little community college up in Palo Alto called Foothill College.
Wow.
Yeah, I had originally, and my hope was to get into Stanford or one of the good UCs, but it looked like to get in for fall of 2016, you'd have to apply in like December, January, which I didn't have. I wouldn't have my ducks in a row.
We learned that in high school, but that's
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So,
well, I go to community college. That's great. And then if you wanted to apply for transfer, I bet you could do it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a feeder college to a lot of places like Stanford,
sure.
and whatnot. So, yeah. So, in August, I had a big surgery to take out that giant 15-centimeter tumor.
Uh-huh.
And then, it made me so anemic. I needed blood transfusion. It was crazy. And I was by July, I was in so much pain. Like, I was getting hospitalized left and right, just You know, I was all messed up. I had so many things going wrong with me.
Wow.
So I was definitely on my way out. And then that surgery, I bounced back from that. And then this new immunotherapy became available called nivolumab.
Uh-huh.
And I've been doing that since the beginning of September. And all the tumors are shrinking. I have no side effects.
Yeah. You've been posting these pictures, which have been really awesome. It's very Brandon-like of you on Facebook, you know, getting your
stuck
IV.
Stuck with needles.
Stuck with an IV. And it's like, round one, fight.
Yes.
And I think the last one I saw was round nine.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's, those are awesome. And and hopefully your Wolverine genes are going to kick in.
Yeah. No, everything is going forward. I still have a couple very, very minor ones. I have a couple of tumors that aren't really shrinking, but they're also not growing. So it looks like things are winning. Now, at the same time, I'm mindful, right? So like my great childhood hero, Carl Sagan, was in the same boat where he was fighting and then it looked like he was winning and then all of a sudden he lost.
Right.
You know, out of nowhere. So, I mean, all I know is in a few months, they could all be gone, but then they could all come back.
Right.
But whatever. I mean, the whole thing for me is like my kind of...
Is there any idea of what caused it?
You know, everyone says like, well, were you exposed to something in Iraq? And it's like, no, I stayed away from depleted uranium. You know. It could be anything. It could have been the sugar-free Red Bulls I was drinking every day. I mean, who knows? It could. I mean, and honestly, when you get to a certain age, your cells have been splitting so long. There's just it's a roll of the dice. You know.
I remember there was someone that I work with. It was interesting. He was a very junior visual effects artist, but he had a background in genetics.
Oh, so as they do.
Hyper educated in that sense. And he was telling us this thing about cancer it's like, well, the fact that we are oxygen needing human beings is our downfall. That means we are going to die. There's no other way around it. Do we need oxygen to survive? That is why, you know, you can do all the antioxidants you want. It's not really eventually it's going to get the best of you in some way.
Yeah, it's chemistry for you.
It's chemistry. So and sometimes you're affected by it earlier, sometimes not. And depending on, you know, obviously there's things that can cause it to be more.
It's just hard for me though, because like I've been in combat quite a bit.
Yeah.
I had enough experience that it was like, okay, it's just another threat I need to deal with. That's why I was saying, hey, I have cancer, but I'm doing everything I can to fight it. The thing that was frustrating for me was it wasn't something I could just shoot it in the face and be done with it. You know, it was, I had to rely on other people and it was this weird kind of subjective thing, you know?
Yeah. You know? It's not, you had control over every problem in your life before a little bit more.
Well, pretty much. Yeah.
And or it was a decision you were making, right?
True.
You had to relinquish your decision-making to someone else at this point.
Yeah. And that was really a hard thing to deal with. And the other thing that was strange too, was having this kind of dual mindset that was like always happening at the same time. I had this feeling of, oh man, this is it. This is how I go out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially when I had all just nothing but bad news constantly. It was like, well, maybe this is how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of me was like, man, I had so much I still want to do. Another part of me was like, you know, well, it's okay. I've lived a full life.
You have lived a full life, but it's not over.
No, I agree. But my whole point being is that, no, I wasn't going to, you know, I was going to go out fighting for sure.
No, but what you're doing is you're like, all right, I want to get that education that I want. So go ahead and do that.
Yeah. But it was also like, you know, in combat, a big part of it is, you know, everyone's scared and it can be like paralyzingly scary.
Sure.
And what is required for you to get your job done, obviously, in a situation like that is you kind of overcome your fear by saying, okay, what's the worst that can happen to me? Well, my head could explode. All right. Well, now we accept that. Let's move on and get things done.
Right.
And that was kind of the same thing. Well, it could take me out, but, you know, or I could survive. So let's just, you know, deal with it.
Yeah, because otherwise you're just going to sit there and paralyzed in fear.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's not.
And it was a really frustrating thing. At one point when I was recovering from surgery, I was roomed with a guy who was in his early 20s who had just been diagnosed with brain cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy was just giving up. People were coming in, doctors like, hey, we need to do an MRI to look at the tumor. And he's like, what's the point? You know, and I just wanted to reach through the curtain and just choke that guy out. It's just like, you know, your ancestors, you know, fought off megafauna 10,000 years ago so you could be here and you're just giving up, you know? It's like, act like you evolved and grow a pair and just start fighting. It was really frustrating.
How old was this person?
He was in early 20s. Yeah.
Well, take him out of the gene pool, right? Sorry, that sounds mean.
That's one way of looking at it, I suppose.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm a little bit of an atheist, but that's okay.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
I think it's been really good. I love the fact that I've been in touch with you. I love the fact that when I see your post about cancer, it's very uplifting.
Yeah, I mean, there's no point in freaking people out. It's kind of like when I was doing that blog from Iraq, I really sanitized it because I didn't want to freak people out too much. I mean, I told some funny stories that actually had a very scary component to it.
Yeah.
But generally, I was just trying to show people what I was doing, and I didn't want to just, like, freak them out. That's why, like, with the cancer, it's the same thing. It's like, yep, my spirits are up. I'm doing what I can.
Yeah. I think it's a good thing, and I think that a lot of people, especially those, you know, with a good head on their shoulders, have that attitude because that's the best way to get over it. David Tracy's wife had pretty bad breast cancer, right? And she went through some serious chemotherapy and double mastectomy and all that other stuff. And it was really, but she wrote a big blog about it, and her blog posts are hilarious, right? And that's kind of a good way of dealing with it and allowing. It also is a really good way to invite your friends into your life in a way that makes it feel like if you're like, well, I'm really thinking about life and I don't know what it all means anymore. That's not very easy to respond to. It's not very relatable in a way, but you're making it like, hey, you know what? Some shit's going down and I start realizing what's important to me and I'm having I'm just going to be okay with it. Then it makes people feel a lot better about it. So
I appreciate that.
Well, yeah. So you got out of the industry for obviously good reasons. Yeah. You're going to go back to doing the things that I think you wanted to do. Are you going to take anything? What? Okay. All right. So you've had that career in visual effects. What would you say you took away from it?
I lived a childhood dream. You know, I wanted to work on movies. You know, I was one of those Star Wars kids, age 6, that was like, I want to.
Yeah. You're the same age as me. You're 71, right?
I turned 45 in 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Yeah. Okay. So you're January 71. I'm March 71.
Yep. Yep.
So you were 6 when you saw Star Wars. Same as me.
Yeah.
Saw it in theaters.
Yeah. And I had that thing growing up where I wanted to be a soldier, but I also wanted to work on movies.
Yep.
And I've thankfully got to live both of those. You know? So that's one of my big takeaways is having, you know, worked on these films. And, you know, I worked on a lot of turkeys.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Oh, man. But they were the big blockbusters I would have liked as a kid anyway, you know? Speed Racer was one of those ones where I, like, fought so hard to get on because this was a childhood dream of mine. And if I can't work on Godzilla and I can't work on Star Wars, I'm going to work on Speed Racer. And too bad that turned into a – that was, like, the hardest movie. It was like A Day After Tomorrow all over again.
Yeah. I heard about Speed Racer.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's so it was a, but do you think did it live up to your dreams, or did you say now I'm just ready to move on, or did?
Yeah, I'm ready to move on. I think I've done everything I wanted to do. I probably should have tried to work at ILM a long time ago because that would have made it a nice full circle. But you know, I never applied, never even tried.
Right.
And so that's maybe one potential regret. But I think the most important takeaway actually is just the people. I have made so many lifelong friends from the industry than I have than even in my, I have great bonds with people from the Army, but it's only a handful of people I stay in touch with. And there are people that I've made friends with, in the industry around the world that I talk to regularly.
Yeah. I got to say, you know, having left production myself, that is one thing that I think is the thing I enjoy the most, just as much as you said, is like the friends I've made and the things, the bonding I make. And that's kind of why I'm capitalizing on my passion. It's like your shooting experience, right? I'm good at shooting. I love doing it. I'm going to do it on the weekends. Well, I love hanging out with my friends, and I've got a company now that allows me to do a lot of different things. And it's like, I'm going to do a podcast out of this.
Yeah.
So I've capitalized on that. And I think it's a good thing to talk to people and understand a little bit of perspective. And
it's good when we've been there too. It's not like we're like starting out. We've been through the trenches and all these things.
Yeah.
So it's nice to, it's actually pretty fun to kind of go back and reflect on those years and
absolutely
how formative they are.
Yeah, they were very formative. You know, what was weird about specifically, let's go back to Day After Tomorrow for a second, all that, it was a little bit regressive for me because, you know, I'm gone to college, and you know, there was all the crazy frat boy scene, et cetera, et cetera. I left that, and I finally like went to grad school, where it was like, okay, now at least you're thinking about something that's your actual formal education and what's going to form yourself, et cetera. And that's really where I really sort of clicked to me the importance of self-education and the importance of, you know, I started to realize a little bit in college, but really in grad school, I realized all these teachers, they work for me. That's their job is for me. So I don't give a crap if I get a good grade or bad grade. If I get a bad grade, it's their fault, you know? And I'm the only person, I'm responsible for not just taking advantage of it. But if I get a, I'm putting my effort in there, and if I get a bad grade, that's because they didn't educate me correctly. So I put a lot of responsibility back on the teachers, and I think that's something I learned from there. But when I get back to DD and stuff, and I'm like, well, let's start partying. You know, when shit goes down, it was, and so it was a little
work
bit.
Work hard, play hard.
Work hard, play hard. We worked really hard. Yeah. We worked very, very hard, but we did a lot of partying because it was like, it, that was our outlet. So it was a little bit regressive in that way. But like you said, I don't regret it.
Yeah.
Because of all those amazing friendships I made over that time. And yeah, I think absolutely. That was a really, really big thing for me. And, you know, Day After Tomorrow is a weird movie.
Yeah. It's the only time I ever got two credits.
Really?
Yeah. I worked at it at three different places, actually. But yeah, I got two credits, Uncharted Territory and DD.
Oh.
And the funny thing is I worked on the same scene at two different places.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Which scene was that?
The helicopters crashing in the snow.
That's right.
So weird. In fact, I was out with Ben Grossen the other night. Uh-huh. We were talking about that, and he was telling this whole story about how that happened and then how he brought me up to help out at the orphanage for a weekend. And he's right. like, these are the shots. I'm like, oh, I know those.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny because I had been building all the New York models, right?
Yep. Yeah.
We're like, oh, this is going to be an amazing asset for digital domain. We're going to have all these buildings and we can use them for all these other movies, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
And then we had to give them to everyone.
Yep.
So everyone had those models of New York City.
Yep.
So, yep. So if you see a shot of New York City that takes place around the Midtown area, chances are, no matter what movie it is, I probably model some of
that's
those
right. yeah, that's true.
So, all right. Well, this has been amazing, Brandon. I'm really glad to. Well, first of all, we should know that you barely walked in the door and I sat you in front of a microphone.
Yeah.
Because I was like, well, let's go out to lunch. And he's like, no, I just had a big breakfast.
Hey, man, I always show up ready.
Yeah, okay. So I was like, well, let's just figure out what's going on and talk. So it's been really cool to see you. And we'll definitely obviously stay in touch on Facebook.
Yeah,
I'm glad always. You're going back to school.
I start school. My beginning career as a student, I suppose, starts on Monday the 4th.
Right.
Yeah. So
see if I can get your pencils ready. Get your backpack.
Yep. See if I can learn some astrophysics, computational physics, something like that.
What is your interest? Is your interest in physics?
Oh yeah, it's physics as a general thing. I'm most interested in computational physics, which is using, coding to basically run simulations and in actual science simulations, not visual effects.
But you realize you're going in as a freshman.
Yeah.
So you're gonna have to do like, you know, distribution requirement. You can't just go in as a physics person.
Of course not. No. So that's
you're going to have to take like French classes.
Yeah,
maybe.
No. Oh, hey, you know what, Mike? I have literally 2 years of math to do. And so I'm doing this accelerated algebra thing because I tested into algebra, which is what I had in high school.
Uh-huh.
And it's two algebra classes in one quarter. So it's basically 10 units. I'm going into a pretty crazy thing.
Right. And then you're going to... You have to get into calculus.
That was the reason. So
a calculus equation tattooed on your arm.
I know. Old Navier-Stokes. Yeah, I like math. But when I was young. But
I love math.
What's funny, though, is that I do that. I have to do the requisite how to go to school class, how to go to college. It's like a one-unit class you have to take.
Uh-huh.
And I need one other unit to be full-time. And so I'm taking a yoga class.
Nice. I remember... I was a cross country runner and a long distance and I did track as well. And I did so by doing that, I fulfilled all of my there's a P requirement, believe it or not, in college as well. I fulfilled all of them, but I didn't realize there were still three I needed. It's like, but I run every day.
Right.
I run 14 miles a day, 100 miles a week. How am I not fulfilling my PE requirements? And they were saying, well, you still need three. And I'm like, crap, I need to graduate. So I found this thing where I signed up for it. And I signed up for it like a few months before. And it was whitewater rafting. And I could get 3 credits in one day to do whitewater rafting. So I was like, great, I signed up for that. Well, it turns out that it happened the day that I signed up for it was, like I said, it was a few months before. But it was after the big blizzard in 1993 in the Northeast.
Oh, yeah.
So all the snow was melting. And the water was 29 degrees.
Oh dear.
And it was class 5 rapids because of all the snow melt.
Yeah.
And I was at, so my first experience in whitewater rafting was in 29 degree snowy whitewater.
Very high flux fluids. Yeah. Yes.
Scary as hell. But yeah, I remember that specifically.
Ooh. Yeah, when I went with the counselor, he goes, well, if you get me your military record, I think there's certain things you just probably won't have to take just because having a really right. specialized, you know, military record, it's like, I think your PE requirements are probably done.
You know, I'm just going to say this because, you know, you're going to have to take a whole bunch of math.
Oh, yeah.
And I went in thinking I was going to do computer science, right? And the computer science department that I was working with at Colgate, I didn't really like the teachers there that much, but I love my math teachers. And I only took the math to do computer science.
Right.
And then I realized that, oh, fucking, I don't want to do computer science. I literally was obsessed with doing computer science. And I said, I don't want to do that. And I was also taking some art classes because I like doing art.
Yeah.
And I said, so, you know what? And I talked to one of the people in the math department who was awesome. I said, you know what? I'm going to continue doing this math thing because I really like it. And it's getting weird now, which I kind of like even more because it's doing things in math that I didn't know were possible. Like right. really gets kind of crazy out there, right? And I talked about this with Doug Robel, by the way, on the podcast. Yeah. You know, with abstract algebra and real analysis and topology and non-Euclidean geometry was just like, it's kind of like mind shifting.
Mechanics of the cosmos, yeah. man.
or not even the cosmos, because it's not based on anything that needs to be thought of in a logical way, right? Like Poincaré space is not something that you really, it doesn't matter if it's real or not.
Yeah.
It's just a thing that has a different logic to it, which causes other logic to happen. And it's just kind of a very interesting thing because what does this imply down the line in mathematics and like ring theory, kind of crazy stuff. So I got it and it's just something I didn't expect. And I think you should at least try to, if you're taking a few math classes and you get into it and you're like, get through your calculus stuff, right? Which you're going to have to do. Get into a little bit of real analysis. Do just a little bit of something different. Because once you start dealing with math where there's no numbers anymore, it's mostly just Greek letters and shit.
Yeah.
it gets cool.
Yeah, I mean, to...
If you have the right teacher.
True.
If you have the right teacher.
And, you know, to transfer into a physics program at a UC or Stanford, for example, I have to go past all of the calculus plus differential equations and linear algebra as well.
Right.
So...
Once you get through those things... And the real analysis, abstract algebra to me was great because basically you're saying I'm going to create an algebra system out of a completely different set of elements as opposed to the numbers that I'm used to, right? And it gets very strange. Like, what if all the numbers were only 5 numbers, right? What if you only had 5 numbers? How would math work that way? You know, and it would be kind of weird to think that way. So
it's funny though. I mean, my interest in this, I always was interested in astrophysics, but the way that the effects industry or the in visual effects, the effects side had gone from simple dumb particles and volumetrics into fluid simulations.
Yep. Like
that made me interested in computational physics.
Right.
And I like the idea of, wow, I want to study black holes. Well, with a computational physics degree, you can write simulations of black hole mergers and do the actual science on it, not just make pretty pictures.
I was talking that specifically with Doug Robel. I'm trying to find a way that the visual effects industry and, you know, the outside computer science and, you know, science fields have benefited from each other. And how did they give back to each other? Because fluid dynamics specifically is something that the visual effects industry has taken to apply to a very different type of thing that the fluid dynamics people weren't thinking about.
Yep.
And then they're like, oh.
Oh, we can approximate?
We can approximate.
We don't. Like, it doesn't have to be physically correct.
Yeah. And then they're like, oh, okay. And then they took what visual effects has done or computer graphics has done and reapplied it to fluid dynamics. And then it's kind of gone vice versa. So that's really nice. I'd like to see more of that. It's actually a lot. I don't know if you've seen some of the stuff I'm doing with the WikiHuman project.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I want to take the let's bring dead actors back to life concept of what digital humans are. And let's take that and apply it to psychology. Let's apply it to other aspects and sort of see if we can get that interdisciplinary brain churning.
Absolutely.
Thing.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about visual effects artists in general is they usually come from a varied background and they're
Not as much as they used to.
Not as much as they used to, but because, yeah, back when we were starting out, you
there
go,
was
like,
no schools.
Like, oh, and there's not only that, but it was like, oh, wait, you were a stockbroker in New York? Yeah, but I always wanted to do animation, you know?
Right, yeah, yeah. Or like Matthew Butler was like, yeah, I used to work for JPL.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a PhD in the
aeronautical engineering.
Aeronautical engineering. Exactly. But now I decided I'm going to do visual effects.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting. You get really unique, talented people that have like this interesting blend of artistic ability and science ability at the same time. Cool. And I think that can be applied to a lot of different fields.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I'm interested. Like if I actually become a astrophysicist doing computational work and simulation, like hope maybe I can bring in the actual artistic side of it, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of creativity to it.
Absolutely.
And, this is something I learned, specifically from my math background, because I was a math and art major at the same time. A lot of the math people were like, what's the answer? What's the answer?
Yeah.
And I loved finding the answer and then finding an alternate answer.
Right.
You know, finding like, ooh, I like this answer because I find it prettier. And it literally was that prettiness that I looked at the beauty of things. And if you always hear like the Neil deGrasse Tysons and the Carl Sagans and those guys talking about the beauty of science and finding beauty in these things. And those are things that are euphoric, right?
Of course.
They're great. Yeah. And that is something that's creative. I think that there's a lot of creativity behind science. And I think visual effects is a perfect demonstration.
Absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool. Well, I'm going to let you go because it's running long, but it's been awesome seeing you.
Definitely, yeah.
Take care. And it's been a while. And keep us posted. Let us know what's going on. And I'll hopefully you're going to fight this cancer. I know you're going to do it. So
we'll do my best to kick its butt.
And then let us know, when you get into Stanford so that we can come visit you
there.
Yeah,
I'm sure I'll have a post someday. Woo, I'm getting smarter every day.
That's a good series, by the way. Do you ever see that?
Getting Smarter Every Day?
Oh, it's a good one. Yeah. I love that guy.
Yep.
Cool.
Yep.
And you should do one of those. Maybe that's something you can do.
Yeah.
You could do one of those.
Yeah. Yeah. No, maybe when I actually know what I'm talking about. Because, these days I post on Facebook and I'll go off on, read some scientific paper and then I'll kind of break it down for layman stuff. But then sometimes I'm totally wrong with that.
Well, maybe that's something you could do is you could find a way that I think you could do that.
Yeah. I love communicating science. So.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Cool. All right, Brandon. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon.
All righty.